Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Common Sense with Dr. Ben Carson. I'm your host, Ben Carson, and we have a very interesting guest today. We have Andre Archie, PhD, an associate professor of ancient Greek philosophy at Colorado State University. His academic work has been published in the Journal of Philosophical Research, Ancient Philosophy, History of Political Thought, and numerous other publications. And he takes on the whole cult of diversity and equity and inclusion in his new book, The Virtue of Colorblindness. We used to talk about colorblindness as a goal in our society. Professor Archie demolishes the left's embrace of identity politics, arguing that it makes a mockery of Dr. Martin Luther King's vision for America, of a place where his four children could grow up and be judged not by the color of their skin, but the content of their character. Professor, it's great to have you on. Thank you so much for being
here. Dr. Carson, thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to meet you and to discuss my book with you.
Well, let's get right into it. We all are familiar with Dr. King's dream. What happened? Why have we abandoned it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that's what I address in my book, The Virtue of Colorblindness. You know, we've been seeing these patterns for many years now. But I think it's really with the death of George Floyd that many of these academic racialist ideologies sprung, if you will, from the classroom. And I think that what predominates in the public square today is the idea that America is systemically racist. And because it's systemically racist, we have to practice discrimination on behalf of people of color, African Americans in particular. But I think that's completely wrong. It's completely wrong. I came of age in the 80s. As you mentioned, you're familiar as well with the idea that we should strive to be colorblind. People say that's naive, it's simple, but it's naive, and it's simple to do otherwise, because it's easy to judge someone by the color of their skin. That's easy. But the hard part is to look at people and to try to judge them according to their character, because it's their actions. It's their actions that ultimately determine and judge, or at least we would judge, what kind of person are we dealing with? But we've gotten away from that tradition, and so I'm trying to revive that tradition because it's important. Otherwise, it's dangerous.
I agree. It's so simplistic and juvenile, quite frankly, to judge someone on external characteristics. You know, when I go to the operating room and cut that skin and peel it back and take that bone off, I'm operating on the thing that actually makes that person who they are. Skin doesn't make them who they are. The texture of the hair doesn't make them who they are. It's the brain that makes them who they are. And, obviously, if you think deeply and not on just a superficial level, you'll recognize that. But there's so many people in our society who've been trained to be very superficial in their thinking, be more like an animal, to just react to what they see rather than use their intellectual capabilities to analyze.
Exactly.
What's going
and
on.
I mean, you're referring to ascriptive qualities, and we've gotten to the point where we're defining people according to those ascriptive qualities. Ascriptive qualities are non-moral. We're born into the world with certain qualities. And so when you look at the Western philosophical tradition, I think it teaches us that these ascriptive qualities, these secondary qualities, are insignificant. Again, what matters is character. Character is the locus of moral agency, and we've gotten away from that. And what's really problematic is that our young people of color, African Americans in particular, are being told that their color defines who they are, what they can be. And we know that's not the case. You look at Socrates, Aristotle, that whole tradition, those principles that really inform the founding of our country, that whole tradition says otherwise. But recently, we've marginalized those ideas that define us as Americans.
Do you think a lot of this is of recent origin, or has this been a goal for some people for quite some time?
I think it's been a goal for...
To change who we are.
That's right. I think it's been a goal for quite some time. And what a lot of people don't realize, I think you realize, Dr. Carson, you're aware of this history. In the 19th century, you had debates within the black community regarding these sorts of issues. You had those who wanted to immigrate to Africa or Liberia or other parts of the world because they felt as if America was truly racist. Now, at that time, there was a case to be made, but these debates regarding assimilation, regarding racialist ideologies, they've been around for a while. But I think what's happened recently is you have a group of individuals who radically want to change America. They recognize that race and our history with race is the soft underbelly of America. And so they address that, they appeal to that, they picket that to the point of really confusing a lot of people who aren't using their brains regarding our founding principles and who we are as Americans. And so I do think you have ulterior motives of those who raise the voices of many of the people that I discuss. They raise those voices and argue their discussion of race, people like Coates and Kindi and D'Angelo. They argue that those are the true voices of racial reconciliation. And it's just the opposite. They want to take us back. They want to make Americans divided. And this racialist ideology that they promote in the public square is doing just that. It's taking us back. And so we have to get the word out that all of those ideas, DEI, anti-racism, is antithetical to the American project, because the idea of colorblindness is the only way forward in a society as diverse as ours. Otherwise, it's quite dangerous what's to come if we continue down this road.
Well, just to emphasize the point that people have been trying to change our country for a while, if you look at the congressional record, January 10th, 1963, this was read into the record by Congressman Herlong, the goals of communism in America. And there are 45 of them, but I'm just going to read a couple of them, like number 17, get control of the schools. Use them as transmission belts of socialism and current communist propaganda. Soften the curriculum, get control of teachers' association. Put the party line in textbooks. Gain control of all student newspapers. I mean, this is pretty interesting stuff. Infiltrate the press. Get control of book review assignments, editorial writing, policy making positions. Gain key positions in radio, television, and motion pictures. And it just goes on here. Eliminate all laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and a violation of free speech. And break down cultural standards of morality, promoting pornography, obscenity, making homosexuality, degeneracy, promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Infiltrate the churches, replace religion with the social religion, eliminate prayer. I mean, it goes on and on. And it's all the things that are happening in our society today. And I don't want anybody in the audience to be naive enough to think that this is something of recent origin. It seems to be culminating now. And all of the things that I just talked about here, these are parts of cultural Marxism. Can you sort of break down for our audience what cultural Marxism?
Yeah, so all that you just mentioned on the congregational record there, it's happening. And in the first couple of chapters of the book, I mentioned someone by the name of Antonio Gramsci, Italian Marxist. And he says the way that you change societies is you go to their leading institutions. And that's where you radically change how a society operates. And this is exactly what we're seeing. And you see it especially when it comes to the family. I think that's sort of the root of many of these changes. If you can break up the family, or at least redefine the family, but beyond recognition, the young do not have the natural strong foundations to stand on, to argue against it, to fight against it. But I think a lot of people are fooled by the fact that people who claim to be speaking on behalf of people of color, they have another agenda. They have ulterior motives. And so what bothers me, and what the book addresses in particular, is that I think Black Americans have been used as pawns in a lot of respects, but also white Americans to a degree, in order to change our society and its institutions. I mean, we no longer know or what a male is, what a female is. The institution of marriage has been radically revised. And so I think the leading institutions of our society is being subject to a type of Marxism or structuralism, which is the idea that you have these underlying forces that are often economic, but really it's cultural power that's at play. And you have various groups sort of in this power play, and then you have pawns around that power play. And we're the subject of that. As American citizens, we're the subject of that. And so I think that accounts for a lot of the changes that we've seen in our society. And as you said, it's starting to culminate, or it has been culminating. And so I try to get into some of those issues, but I do think that our founding principles can provide a roadmap if we take them seriously, because the way that we deal with identity politics now, it's not effective, because what they're arguing is atavistic. So we need another approach to deal with these racialist ideologies of the public square.
Well, your description of pawns is very accurate. People being just moved around and used for someone else's purposes. Vladimir Lenin called them useful idiots because they don't even recognize that they're destroying their own future and the future of their children. They just run around with signs yelling because someone has told them that this is unjust. And don't believe your eyes and ears. Just listen to me. Right. I'll tell you what you're supposed to think. It's pretty amazing. But, you know, it's a little bit interesting in our society today. There seems to be a degree of migration in the Black community back toward common sense again, back toward analyzing who's actually being helpful and who's using them. And that is somewhat promising to me.
I would agree with you. I'm sorry to interrupt. I would argue that's certainly the case. Because, I mean, we see the results of a lot of the policies that are being enacted on our behalf. And again, I think Exhibit A is the family. I mean, you know, we have editorialists in the New York Times arguing that single-parent home should be the standard. Now, of course, I mean, my father wasn't around. I mean, I knew my father, but he wasn't as engaged as a father should be, or as engaged as I am, I would like to think, with my children. But I think I know that having a mother and a father in the home is conducive to flourishing families and flourishing children. So I think that I think a lot in the African American community are starting to realize that what we're being told, at least from those left of center hasn't quite worked out when you have 70% of black children born into single parent families. I mean,
what's really interesting is you have a lot of people talking about the wealth gap between blacks and whites in this country. And it is, it's real. There's no question about it. It's pretty dramatic, actually. But if you look at Nigerians who migrate here, Ghanaians, some other people with black skin who migrate here, there's no wealth gap. And you have to ask yourself, why is that? Well, go into a Nigerian family's home. You'll find that bachelor's degree is the baseline. That's where you start. And there's a tremendous emphasis on family. And if you take a traditional black family in America, where those are values that are important to them, education and family, also there's very little in the way of wealth gap, if any at all. So maybe people are looking at the wrong thing when they're just looking at the color of the skin. Maybe they should be looking at some other factors when talking about that.
Yeah, Dr. Carson, I mean, I don't understand why more people don't see that. I mean, what you just said seems so commonsensical. I mean, that's true. I have many friends who are Nigerian, West Indian, and it's a cultural difference compared to Native Black Americans. I mean, I'm generalizing here, but what you say is exactly right. And even when you look at places like Harvard, I mean, it's so interesting what happened recently there with the ex-president. Henry Louis Gates, African-American professor there.
Who was in my class at Yale. I've known him.
Okay, okay. Yeah, so you probably know that him several years back, as well as Lonnie Guinier, I think the late Lonnie Guinier, they talked about how Harvard, that the students of color are mainly immigrants. They're Africans, they're West Indians, and there was some disgruntlement about that. You don't hear about that much anymore, but it speaks to exactly what you said. There's a cultural difference, and it doesn't mean that things can't change, but there's certainly a cultural difference that account for a lot of the disparities that we find between black Americans and white Americans. I mean, there's a cultural deficit in a lot of respects, and so we need to talk more about that, but again, there are people out there in the legacy media who don't want to acknowledge that because it sort of interrupts their narrative. And we have to break through that. I think it's key that we break through that.
Well, we'll be right back in 1 minute with our fascinating guest, talking about his book, talking about race in our society, racial identification, and how it is hurting us rather than helping us. We'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back with Professor Andre Archie, and he has a fascinating new book called The Virtue of Color Blindness, something we used to talk about as a goal in our society. And now we're in a situation where academic institutions, corporate America, Hollywood, just about everybody is embracing DEI. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. I think it probably was envisioned as something that would be useful and very helpful and help us as a society. But is it your impression that it is helping us?
No, it's not helping us. I mean, you know, originally in 1964 with the Civil Rights legislation, Title VI, I mean, it was required, at least for some governmental departments, to have diversity training. They didn't call it that back then. It was like cultural awareness or something, just to make sure that there was that certain departments in government would conform to that legislation. But what that's evolved into is the idea that people of color are victims and white people are mm-hmm. victimizers, and that in fact the system as a whole is designed to subordinate people of color to white Americans. And so if that's the assumption, and also that plays into that whole Marxist framework, if that's the assumption, then we have to do everything we can to radically reorient, to change society, to accommodate, or at least to correct for the past. And so mm-hmm. it hasn't helped at all. It's creating resentment, the fact that we have to undergo, or at least in some professions, in a lot of professions, we have to undergo diversity training. But it creates resentment. And it doesn't have a goal. It's not clear what exactly we're trying to accomplish. Are we trying to make people more conscious of race? If that's the case, it doesn't work, because we do it in all the wrong ways. And so this idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion, I think ultimately it's a power play. I mean, if you look at the leading figures, those who are diversity trainers, they're doing quite well. Universities have spent millions of dollars. There's sort of a cadre of administrators who are dedicated to supposedly promoting equity. But equity is simply discrimination. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah, well, to just have a personal example of how ridiculous it is, recently Glass Lewis, which is a proxy advisory service for corporate America, recommended that people vote against me for one of the boards that I sit on, because I'm the chairman of the Nomination and Governance Committee. And we had to add two people as part of our succession planning, because somebody's going to have to go off soon.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, we went from 33% women to 25% women. They said, they're discriminating, they're horrible people. No. the stockholders didn't pay much attention to them. But isn't it interesting that they would go to the point of saying it's more important to check their box than it is to look out for the welfare of their company and for the benefit of the stockholders?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's quite amazing the degree to which this ideology, DEI, the degree to which it's taken over. Even people that are smart, presumably, at least in other areas, they're not critical at all, or at least maybe they have motives for not being critical of what's happening right in front of their faces. But I think a lot of people know intuitively that a lot of the practices that we associate with anti-racism or with DEI is just unfair. They're antithetical to the idea of individualism that we all share as Americans.
Well, they throw logic out of the window, because if the stockholders had taken their advice and voted against me, then they would have said, now they don't meet their minority quantity. they're
confused.
It's almost comical.
Yeah.
It's almost comical when you look at them. But we're running around in circles trying to check boxes rather than looking at what needs to be done.
And it's condescending. And it's condescending. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, it's as if, you know, the people on behalf that these policies are being enacted, you would think they have no agency whatsoever. And I mean, the people who supposedly benefit from it, aren't they aware of that? I mean, it's such a condescending perspective towards a group of people and Americans in general, that it's hard to think that things won't change, which I do see signs of things ultimately changing.
But things like critical race theory, what do they see as the long-term benefit of that? I'm not quite sure I understand where they see this being beneficial in the long run. Because as you've mentioned, all it does is create resentment and it divides people. And it seems like there are people in our society today who are trying to divide us on the basis of race, age, income, gender, religion, political affiliation, you name it, drive a wedge, divide people. Who benefits from that?
I do think, Dr. Carson, I do think that there's a group of people who truly believe that DEI and anti-racism is needed because of what we did to people of color, of Black Americans in particular. I do think there's a group of people who genuinely feel it's warranted. I think those people are completely wrongheaded. And I'm not sure what to do with those people. I mean, in the book, I do refer to a lot of those individuals as useful idiots. So I think that group, you know, they're just confused. And I think there's another group that they have benefited. And I think that's the whole sort of administrative state in which these policies are being enacted. I mean, you look at this administration now. I mean, every policy is aimed towards DEI. And just the rhetoric around that is so condescending. And I can see right through it, but you have people in positions of power who truly believe that the only way to change society, or at least to enact these policies to change society in their direction, is to promote anti-racism, DEI. So I think that there's this synergistic play at work in which you have very conscious people doing it for deliberate purposes to change society. And then again, that group of people who think that we all benefit from these policies because our past has been so cruel.
Well, you know, when you look back at the things that made this into a great country, which is what American Cornerstone Institute is all about, the institution that I head up, one of the cornerstone principles is community. And that was so important in the development of our country because you had people who were from all kinds of different places, and you'd have a community consisting of 100 families, and there was no other community within 50 or 100 miles. Not only did they survive, but they thrived because they understood the common good. That was a phrase that we use often in the development of our country. What works for everybody? And if it was harvest time and Mr. Jones broke his leg, everybody else harvested his crops. No questions asked. Didn't care what his religion was or what his political affiliation. He was their neighbor. And, you know, one of our other principles, cornerstone, was faith. And our Judeo-Christian values taught us to love your neighbor, not to cancel your neighbor if they have a different yard sign, not to hate them if they don't agree with you on everything. And as we've moved away from the various cornerstone principles, it makes room for people who want to divide us, who want to gain power, because it's all about gaining power. And our founders understood that. They studied every government that ever existed, and they concluded that no matter how they start and how lofty their goals are, they all end up the same way, growing, infiltrating, and dominating. And they want to give us a constitution that would keep that from happening in our country. And all of this is sort of aimed at destroying that sense of community that helped to make us into an incredibly strong country. But one of the things I want to ask you about, and you talk about this in the virtue of colorblindness, is the amazing progress that has actually been made in the Black community. I mean, I remember as a young child going to Tennessee and seeing the colored and white only signs over the drinking fountains and people explaining to me, you know, you have to do this. You have to do this. This is not Detroit. But in the same lifetime, we have black admirals and generals and CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and heads of foundations and university presidents. We've had a black president of the United States. I mean, for those people on the left who say we haven't really made any progress, what are they drinking? Why do you think they continue to insist that we're not making any progress and that things are just as horrible as...
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And we've made tremendous progress, especially when you look at sort of the beginnings, our origins on these shores. I think it's amazing. And the family itself has been a sort of a bulwark against many of the forces that have been against us in the past. And so... It doesn't make any sense why, or at least I have some ideas why, but it wouldn't seem to make any sense that they would argue this way. But getting back really quickly to your first point earlier, you know, you were describing civic republicanism, the idea that these sort of intermediate institutions like community brought us together at one time. And that's sort of an animating tradition that continues to do exactly what the founders intended, which is to have this common narrative that we can appeal to, even beyond our particularities of race or religion. There are these common core beliefs, these cornerstones that you mentioned. So that idea of civic republicanism being engaged is quite animating, and that's exactly what I appealed to in the book. And so tying that to what we were just talking about, it doesn't make any sense to me at all other than to say there are those who have ulterior motives in terms of saying things haven't changed from the past for many people of color. I think that's the only way that we can justify that sort of claim. I mean, they have some other ulterior motive, and blacks are sort of construed, people of color are sort of construed as pawns, as I mentioned. And so that gives them sort of a battering ram to enact certain policies, certain legislation. But it makes no sense to argue that things haven't changed in America. It certainly has. And that whole idea of the success sequence, I mean, that's been an animating feature for black Americans in particular. And that's been a recipe for success. You know, you work hard, you study, you play by the rules. I think America still promises many great things if you can subscribe to that belief.
I used to hear that a lot. Back when I was a kid, you don't seem to hear it nearly as much now because you have people saying, well, maybe that's true right. for this group, but that's not really true for you. And obviously, if you believe you're a victim, you exactly. become a victim. Well, we'll be right back in 1 minute with our fascinating guest, Professor Andre Archie. We'll be right back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
We're back with Professor Andre Archie. He has a fascinating new book called The Virtue of Color Blindness, something we used to talk about as a goal in our society. You know, I think it's fascinating. People who see racism in everything, no matter what you say to them, See, I told you, you're racist. And no matter what you do, you're doing that because you're racist, because that's what
you're
looking
for. That's right.
And, you know, my mother always emphasized to us, you know, even if somebody is racist, that doesn't have to control you. You're the person who controls yourself. And, you know, she made us read books. And we didn't like it much at first, but as you started reading about explorers and surgeons and scientists and inventors, you begin to understand that the person who has the most to do with what happens to you is you. It's not somebody else. It's not some barrier that they put up. It's you and how you react. And once I understood that, I just kind of threw all that garbage in the garbage can. People say, you can't do this and you can't do that. And so I said, maybe you can't do it. You can't tell me what I can do. And, you know, this is the attitude that we need to instill in our young people, and particularly our young black males, because as many studies have shown, because so few of them grow up in traditional nuclear families with that male presence and that role model, they're at an enormous disadvantage.
That's right.
And now the rest of society is catching up because the nuclear family is breaking down all over the place, and you're starting to see the same kind of problems. And if we were observant, you know, we would look at some of the things like the studies done by the Brookings Institute on poverty. You know, the success sequence there. You know, less than a 3% chance of living in poverty if you finish high school, get a job, wait till you're married to have children. Do those things, less than a 3% chance that you'll live in poverty. Why don't we do that? It's so simple.
Yeah, no, it is very simple. And as I point out in the book, I think black Americans deserve to be very confident. I mean, we've come far. We've worked hard. We've been successful. I mean, if any group should be confident, even cocky, I think black Americans should. I think we have a lot to be proud of. But I think lately, this idea or this anti-success sequence is doing a lot of damage. When you tell young children that they're not in control of their fate because the system is stacked against them, what exactly are you doing? That's a type of child abuse. And I think, and I do think for black males in particular, as you mentioned, Brad Wilcox as well, University of Virginia, the Marriage Project, he shows that, you know, there's a structure that especially benefits black males with families with fathers, right? And so, again, not all families can have nuclear families, right? Not all families can be nuclear families. But in the past, we had intermediate institutions that would step in and they would preach that success sequence. But nowadays, it's either the family or government. Those intermediate institutions are no longer doing what they did at once upon a time. Now, there are some, of course, there are some. But I mean, in general, the message that we're getting is that the system is rigged. There's structural racism. And so we need government in order to correct the past. And I think it's just the opposite. Right. And that does a lot of damage to both our society and to the young.
Well, you've hit on the crux of the matter. You know, what is America? America was a place that was supposed to be of, by, and for the people. And there is a group now who wants it to be of, by, and for government. That's the essential difference between us and other places. And it was that philosophy that led us from a bunch of ragtag militiamen to the pinnacle of the world in record time. It was not a coincidence. It was because of the belief systems that we had. This is not to say that we were a perfect country. It's not to say that we did everything correctly, because we didn't. We have people who inhabit the country, and therefore you're going to have mistakes made. And some people say, how can you say anything good about America because America had slavery? Well, so did everybody else. Go back through history. Way back as far as you can go, slavery. It's been a problem. That is not something that makes us unique because we had slavery. What makes us unique is that, as far as I know, we're the only country that fought a bloody civil war. Get rid of the evil institution and lost a large portion of our population because so many people were vehemently opposed to it. And that's maybe what we should be teaching our children. And we should learn from our mistakes and move forward. It's so vitally important. But as we close, I just want to ask you, you know, as a successful Black American, what advice would you give to younger generations who believe they're being oppressed by systemic racism?
You know, I would say that, first of all, look at our past. Look how far we've come as Black Americans. I would say that if that young person, if they study, if they work hard, if they put effort into what it is that they take joy in, they're going to be successful in their lives. It doesn't promise perhaps lots of money. Maybe that'll come along with it. But it will make possible a flourishing life and ultimately happiness. I mean, ultimately, that's what our project, the American Project, is about, is to be happy and to flourish. And so I would say this idea of systemic racism, it's not true. There are racists, sure, but the idea that the whole system is rigged against you, it's not true. And if you put forth effort, you'll start to see the rewards of your effort. So I think that young children, what we should teach them is that if they express and if they act in their God-given capabilities, they'll flourish and they'll be happy within their circumstances. And that's all that we can promise. I mean, but that's a lot.
That is a tremendous amount. Well, I just want to thank you for, you know, investing time in this project, for writing this book. And don't forget to go out and get this book, The Virtue of Colorblindness. Now, we can be a colorblind society. We can move past the superficial. We can get into the deep. We can get into what makes a person who we are. And we can reestablish a sense of community. We are not enemies. W-A-N-E, wane. Wax and wane. It's time to wane in terms of all of this animosity that exists in our society and move forward. We create our own problems. The vast majority of issues that are going on in our country are self-inflicted wounds. We need to pray for wisdom. We need to act as logical people once again, not let ideology control what we're doing. And I think we'll be just fine if we do that. And that will be a tremendous blessing for the world because they need leadership too. So, Professor, thank you so much for what you're doing. I'll look forward to actually meeting you.
Dr. Carson, thank you for having me. I mean, you're a good American. I admire you, and I appreciate you inviting me onto your show. Thank you so much.
All righty. And I'll be right back with my closing thoughts in 1 minute.
I normally find bras to be so uncomfortable and constricting, but Skims has changed that. You know I love Skims underwear, so I finally tried their bras, and Skims has delivered again. Skims bras are worth the hype for the amazing shape and support they give, but what I wasn't expecting was how comfortable they are too. I've tried so many bras in the past, and the main issue that I have is that they weren't supportive enough, to the point where they felt slouchy. I love my Skims wireless form bra because it's so comfortable and supportive. The older I get, the more I care about actually being comfortable in what I wear every day. And with my wireless form bra, I no longer have to sacrifice my comfort for the support I need. Shop Skims bras at skims.com, now available in 62 sizes, 30A to 46H. Plus, get free shipping on all orders over $75. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know we sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select our show in the drop-down menu that follows. Thank you.
What a fascinating discussion that was with Professor Andre. That was something that really would make us stop and think. Why are we so concerned about the color of a person's skin? Why is that so important to some people? Well, you know, what I've found throughout my life is that people who think deeply and are very intellectual seldom even notice superficial characteristics. It has no impact on them. People who are very basic, let's put it that way, then things like that become important to them. And what we need to do is help people to understand that it's the brain who makes you who you are, not the color of your skin. That has very little, if anything, to do with it. Isn't it interesting, for instance, you take somebody from Japan who's grown up in London with a London family. They speak with a British accent. They have British customs. It has a lot more to do with where they were brought up than the color of their skin or the shape of their eyes. And we need to understand that, particularly in a country like America, where we have a diversity of people. And that's actually a blessing. Can you imagine how boring it would be if everybody looked exactly like you? That'd be terrible. It'd be a disaster in some cases. So, you know, the Lord has blessed us with diversity. It's not a problem. It's a blessing. And for your prescription this week, I want you to go out there and spread the word that we're all in the same boat, that we are not enemies. And that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Professor Andre Archie. And I hope you'll get his book, The Virtue of Colorblindness. And make sure you subscribe for free, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast from. Rate us, review us, tell your friends about us. Because we have to make common sense common once again. And remember the cornerstones: faith, liberty, community, and life. See you next week.